Hello, comrades. First of all, I want to congratulate you all for this year's Marxism. Every year is an amazing thing that you are managing to organize, but what you are pulling through this year with multiple events in multiple cities and all that is pretty amazing. I would prefer being there, attending the whole conference session after session, but still, I'm happy to contribute. It's great seeing you all, and thank you for the invite to discuss the situation in Greece. Hoping my internet connection will rise up to the occasion, I move on to my introduction. So, as the title of the session suggests, last March in Greece was marked by a return of the resistance in the streets. That's a very fresh development, and it's too soon to evaluate its lasting impact or to make safe predictions on the prospects from now on. But the events of the past few weeks are important in themselves, and in order to understand this importance, we should start by seeing the background. Now, most of you probably know and are familiar that in Greece we've suffered a very important political defeat on the summer of 2015, and we've been experiencing its impact ever since. The Syriza government elected to overthrow austerity and the memorandum signed with international creditors, capitulated to the Greek ruling class and its international allies, and signed a new memorandum with new austerity measures against the outcome of a historical referendum of July 5th of July, when 61% of the Greek people demanded to stand against the blackmails and stop austerity. This was a huge shock, and ever since that time, for 4 years, we've been living in a situation where a party that insists on calling itself the radical left was implementing one neoliberal measure after the other, and they shifted their public discourse in order to justify the policies they were implementing as needed or helpful. The side effect was that the TINA doctrine, there is no alternative, was gaining a new credibility in the Greek public. During the Syriza administration, social movements were dormant. Many activists were either exhausted after 5 or 7 years of struggle on the streets, or demoralized by the betrayal of the Syriza leadership, or both. The dissident left failed to reverse that trend at the time. There were some objective conditions and difficulties, but there were also many subjective mistakes of our own that didn't help reverse the situation. So most groups suffered the impact of that defeat in many ways in the following years. Meanwhile, we had a right-wing opposition which was unable to differentiate itself from Syriza's economic policies, so they tried to inflame sentiments of social conservatives, meaning racism, nationalism, and the law and order doctrine, as the way to build up its support while in opposition. So on June of 2019, the right-wing party of New Democracy returned to power, benefiting from a general right-wing drift in public opinion. It was a delayed electoral expression of the defeat back in 2015. So it was not just an electoral victory because of everything that happened before. Back then, we used the term political victory of the right in order to describe something that was more serious than a simple electoral result. but not a historical defeat. Something that could be reversed, but we remained open-minded about how deep the defeat was or how easy and quickly we could reverse it. From its part, the right-wing party of New Democracy embarked on an effort to utilize our political defeat in order to impose a strategic defeat. Neoliberalism was supposed to be restored as the common sense, as the only way out of the crisis. The slogan was, make Greece an investor-friendly environment. And that's the way forward. Trade unionist activity, leftist ideas, organized political activism would be discredited as pointless, as out of fashion, or even as malicious acts of the enemy within, the left-wing dissent. So early on, the government under Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis stepped on the tragic precedents set by the Syriza administration and accelerated this direction without whatever reservations might have been left to the mutated party of Syriza, of Alexis Tsipras. So privatizations would happen faster, precarity of labor would be generalized more broadly, anti-union laws or anti-refugee policies will continue, but in a more unapologetic way. This right-wing project was based on the assumption of stability and of imposing a new normality. This was a promise to the ruling class mostly and sections of the middle classes who hoped for a new stabilized normal. And it also expressed a hope from their part that after 10 years of constant worsening of the material conditions of the working class, their aspirations will be diminished, so that they will learn to accept this new normal, they said, meaning an economic recovery based on even lower wages and precarious conditions, permanent high levels of unemployment, and so on. This assumption was grasped as we entered the triple crisis early in 2020. One is well known, the health crisis, the pandemic. The second is also well known, the new economic crisis, which I think was already in the making, but the pandemic worked as a catalyst and a trigger for it. A Greek specific in this global situation is the escalation of the already intense Greco-Turkish competition in the Eastern Mediterranean. So I will make a few remarks on each of the one of the crises. The pandemic, of course, was the crucial factor, the game changer. The governmental strategy was about refusing to impose an actual lockdown or even decent health protocols in big capitalist firms, while saving all their rigor and all their strictness to imposing curfews and restrictions that targeted any other social activity during the leisure time of the workers and the youth. This had a double effect. On the one hand, and it is obvious, it failed tragically to contain the virus. It kept spreading in workplaces. So right now, we are in the middle of the worst number in recorded cases since the start of the pandemic 1 year ago, while we have been under curfews and restrictions non-stop since last November. But this strategy failed. On the other hand, people were getting sick of a situation well described by Italian unionist and comrade Eliana Como back in March of 2020. She described it as such: as a worker, you are forced to risk infection at work every day. But then, as a citizen, you are not allowed to enjoy a walk in the park of your neighborhood. That's the situation we've been living through for months in Greece. And putting the cops in charge of enforcing the situation made things even worse, as we shall see later on. Anger on these issues combined with an ideological shift on the public versus private debate. The private sector glorified by new democracy as the motor that will lead us forward was proven completely useless during the pandemic. I talk about private healthcare, which refused to lend a hand for free, and it was widely discredited for its position. Public hospitals, slandered for years as wasteful and so on, were proven as our only line of defense against the rise in recorded cases and the spread of the virus. And yet those hospitals, with an NHS already brought on its knees before the pandemic, after 10 years of austerity and constant cuts, still remain with no reinforcement from the government. They both refuse to support the NHS with new recruits, new clinics, new equipment, and they also refuse to requisition of the public, of the private healthcare facilities that are standing there in times of need. The other aspect that undermined the government's project was, of course, the economic crisis. It was not just about not supporting the workers in this time. Most public resources went to firm owners, and crumbs were left to workers barely enough to survive, either for workers in sectors that were in actual lockdown, bars, restaurants, arts, mostly, or workers in sectors that were affected by the slowdown in activity, like tourism. But it was not just about refusing to support workers in such a crisis. The government thought that the pandemic is an opportunity because of the difficulty in organizing in the way we know, union assemblies, mass rallies, and so on. They thought that they could now accelerate and push one anti-worker legislation after the other in Parliament during the pandemic. Whoa, 10. In order to bypass resistance. Last but not least, the tension in the Eastern Mediterranean. Now the competition between Turkey and Greece is decades long for an hegemonic role in the region, but it escalated in recent years. There has been the so-called East Med Alliance. It's a coordination of Greece, Israel, Cyprus, Egypt, under the auspices of USA and France, to jointly organize the extraction and transfer of natural gas from the source of Israel to Europe. And in order to impose this plan, they had to exclude Turkey from any access to disputed territorial waters. It is an arrogant operation. It goes against any sense of international maritime law or even geographic reality. And in order to promote this plan, the government, apart from signing shameful agreements with wonderful allies like the Zionist state or the dictatorship of Sisi in Egypt, who are the new friends of the Greek state in the area, they started spending actually tens of billions of euros for new warplanes and new warships in order to change the balance of military forces against Turkey in the region. So while we lack basic material in hospitals, we buy new Rafale warplanes, new war frigates, and so on. All these factors contributed in shattering the main pillar of new democracy's attempted counter-revolution to impose a new normality. The vision of a new ultra-neoliberal normal that would be accepted by the majority of society and that would guarantee a right-wing hegemony and the rule of new democracy in a stabilized way was facing an uphill struggle in such a context of multiple crises. So for the government, there was one way to move forward. They doubled down on the second pillar of their war on the left, as they call it, authoritarianism and repression. Also huge money spent on new police recruits, new police units, New police vehicles, new tear gas, new equipment, an amazing sum spent. Past autumn was the climax of this authoritarian turn. We've been through an amazing anti-fascist trial past October during the trial of the neo-Nazis of Golden Dawn. Tens of thousands of people demanded and then celebrated the verdict against the Nazis in the streets of Athens. The government understood the potential that was displayed that day and moved on to a preemptive counteroffensive. So, using the rising cases back in November as an excuse, they imposed very strict bans on all kinds of protests and public rallies. Article 2 of the Constitution, the one that supposedly safeguards the right to protest, was suspended twice by a decree of the chief of the head of the police. It's something that has not been done in Greece since the military junta of 1967, the day of the coup. They banned very important protests and days for the left in Greece. One was the 17th of November, the anniversary of the student uprising against the military junta in November 73. And December the 6th, it's the anniversary of the youth revolt in December 2008 against the police murder of a 15-year-old student. Important dates for the left, state bans. We had to confront very serious repression of the streets to mobilize small actions. In between, even smallest activities faced repression. On the 25th of November, a dozen of left-wing feminist activists, we are proud to say six of them were our comrades, were arrested for raising a banner against violence against women in Syntagma Square. Now, given the weak state of social movements all this time, we estimated that these attacks had a preemptive character, as I said. They were trying to impose a new normal, fearing of what the future might bring. A new normal where protests would be considered a dangerous place to be, where militant minorities would be isolated, face extreme repression, before they appeal and manage to mobilize broader sectors of the population. So while the police cracked down on the streets, there was also an ideological offensive. They tried to discredit the radical left as troublemakers who deserve to be brutalized, as the enemy within that must be suppressed. Law and order was the only narrative that New Democracy had to offer to its conservative base of support in order to rally its rank and file against the enemy, as its own base of support was cracking under the weight of the financial crisis. During that time, we had to face both the pandemic itself, the spread of the virus and the fear of it, and state repression. So we were forced to organize what we called delegated resistance, small symbolic activities organized by organized militant minorities, trying to express the mood of a wider layer of the population that was either not willing or not able to take to the streets at that time. There are many stories to tell from that time. Operating in a semi-clandestine way was a brand new experience for most of us. And mostly it was a very hard terrain for our group, who always argued that mass action is the best way to fight back against repression. So we were in a situation that we searched for ways of keeping the flame of resistance alive in that way, and waiting for the situation to change. Thankfully, things changed after January this year. There was a new law that further accelerated neoliberal reform of higher education, and at the same time was providing that police forces would be present permanently in university campuses. This is a big taboo in Greece. University spaces used to be asylum, police-free zones, and police were not allowed even to enter. Not only they could enter, we would have permanent police patrols every day on campus. That's what the law says. So there were calls for resistance to this law and weekly student protests. And they were massive. We had thousands of university students marching each week on the streets of Athens against this new law, against this provocation. It marked the end of the period I described as delegated resistance. We had actual protests with masses of people showing up and taking to the streets next to the militant minorities that called for them. We hope that students would set an example to other sectors, that we need to defy repression, that despite the tough situation of the pandemic, protest matters. So as things were starting to change, in this critical conjuncture, we were forced to engage in a very desperate, very hard and very determined struggle. It was about human rights and about saving a man's life, but it also had a very strong symbolism that summed up our fight against right-wing revanchism. It was the hunger strike of Dimitris Koufodinas. Now, prisoner Koufodinas is a former member of the dissolved armed group 17th of November. He went on hunger strike to protest yet another unfair treatment. I won't go into the details, the legal details of the situation. I will just mention that Koufodinas has been treated with harsh vengeance during all his time in prison, since 2002, when he was arrested, with state bureaucracies constantly refusing him many rights that are granted to all other prisoners with similar sentences. So the government treated the hunger strike with a savage cynicism. It was vengeance against Koufodinas himself, but it was combined with a war mentality against the left. They made crystal clear that they will not back down, that they were willing or even hoping to let Koufodinas die. It was an imitation of Margaret Thatcher, who let Bobby Sands and his comrades die in jail in order to prove that the lady is not for turning. It was a similar message from our prime minister to Greek society. But it also carried a very specific, strong symbolism. Koufodinas was shaped politically during the militant years after the fall of the dictatorship. His organization, 17th of November, was a product of that time. So displaying zero tolerance and refusing the minimum rights of this particular prisoner fitted to the narrative of the war on the left, that we must finish off all those traditions of the 70s, not the urban guerrilla type. That is a different discussion to have, and it's not the time to have it. But on the face of Dimitris Koufodinas, it was a war on the militant traditions of the left. So an issue of human rights and democratic rights was portrayed as a struggle against terrorism. And anyone who dared to support Koufodinas' rights was labeled as a terrorist sympathizer. Mass media, government officials...
20 minutes, Panos.
Okay. Even Facebook posts in support of his demands were deleted and user profiles were taken down for supporting the actions of a terrorist group, just for saying that he should be treated equally as a prisoner. And we had a new standard in repression. Smaller allies of a dozen of people would be attacked by dozens of riot police units even before they had the time to raise a banner. We were not allowed to protest for this case. It was a strategy that pursued polarization against the left in a very difficult subject for the majority of society, and against the left that was in the minority. And it aimed to set a precedent for the all future struggles. The vision could be roughly described as A tiny minority insists on active resistance and suffers from brutal repression. One part of the population will be too scared to mobilize on the side of the militants, while another part, the conservatives, will applaud the police for dealing with the hated extremists, terrorist sympathizers, and so on. Thankfully, the Kfodina's affair took a different turn. Week after week, his health was getting worse, and it became clear to everyone that Greece was on the verge of becoming the first European country with a dead hunger stranger for the first time since 1981. So there was an outcry. Academics, artists, doctors, lawyers, left-wing mostly European MPs, called to respect his rights. The Amnesty International, the Greek Ombudsman, and even, it was a shocking thing, the Greek Association of Judges and Attorneys put the blame on the government, calling for it to do something before Kfodinas dies. All the parliamentary opposition, except for the far right, called to respect his demands. And the most important thing is that protests, very small and weekly until then, became daily, day after day, a new protest in Athens, and they became larger and larger every day that passed. So you could say that we saw the paradox of repression playing out. This schema, this scheme, paradox of repression, implies that when a government cannot rule by consent, it relies solely on repression to pacify the population. But at some point, constant use of repression stops terrifying the population and ends up enraging it more. We had a catalyst to bring this feeling to the surface in the municipality of Attica called Neas Mir. During a police raid for checking traffic for the pandemic, one young person was brutalized, and it was recorded by other citizens with their smartphones and went all over the internet. The video went viral, and the young man's cry, "I'm in pain," while the police was beating him, became a rallying cry for thousands of people. It was an effect quite similar to George Floyd's "I Can't Breathe" in American society past summer. And the next day was an amazing earthquake that no one predicted. Over 10,000 people rallied in the central square of Neas Mirni against police brutality. Now this number is, we could celebrate it as a huge success, even if it was a central protest in downtown Athens in Syntagma Square. It was just a local protest for residents of Neas Mirni. And it was huge, and everyone was there, from the Communist Party to anarchist collectives to the radical left. Even football fans of rival teams joined forces and marched for once united against police brutality. It was a huge event. During that protest, a police skirmishes broke out. A member of a notorious for its brutality police unit was beaten by protesters and sent to hospital. And at this point, we faced a new ideological counteroffensive. The mass media immediately shifted the discussion from police brutality to, quote, violent thugs who almost murdered a police officer. But meanwhile, in the streets of Neas Mirni, his colleagues, the police, went on revenge. It's hard to describe what happened. A video that was published captured his unit shouting, "They are done. Tonight we're going to kill them, let's go and fuck them." And there was a rampage all around the municipality of Neas Mirni. They assaulted stores, apartment blocks, beating anyone they found on their way. Those instances of police violence were also recorded by local residents and went online. So it was like living in two parallel universes. Mainstream media kept talking about the drama of the wounded, valiant police officer, while social media were overfilled with one video after the other of savage police violence in the streets of Neas Mirni. This further angered the people, the media coverage and the reality and the distance between them. So the weekend after that, there were calls for local protests in all towns of Greece and all districts of Athens. They were organized by anarchist groups, left-wing organizations, some worker unions, some local collectives active in social solidarity. Wherever someone had the strength to do such a thing, called for a protest. And what happened was a shock even to the more optimist of us. It's hard to estimate the total numbers of protesters in these events during that weekend. Many districts and many towns have seen the largest local protests they have experienced in many, many years. So there were dozens of simultaneous local protests engaging a few thousand seats. We called it a peaceful revolt comprised of multiple guerrilla-like protests. Guerrilla-like refers to the strategy of decentralizing protest. It was a strategy we discussed back in December as a way to face the twin threat of the pandemic and the repression downtown Athens. It had a relative success in December. Local events were easier for people to access. But it did not compare to what happened this March. The strategy of decentralizing protest met with the actual need of thousands of people to protest on their neighborhoods, to reclaim their right to public space from the police. They were filled with anger. Anger exploded about everything. The police, the handling of the pandemic, the priorities of governmental spending, and so on. I'm in pain was the main slogan. Enough is enough was another that expressed the feeling. And Mitsotakis, you bastard, was the unifying cry. An old slogan raised in 65 against our prime minister's father. It became relevant again for Mitsotakis Jr. And this defiant mood spilled over to all kinds of other struggles in March. We had a very successful feminist strike on the 8th of March. Students are still organizing weekly protests that still attract some thousands. And all kinds of... A new thing is organizing teach-ins in campus, out in the open, as a way to say the campus is ours, not the police. They are not welcome. Art workers are in protest. Okay. The health workers have been in constant mobilization 1 year now. And their latest mobilizations are able to attract even more people in solidarity with health workers. And local events in the neighborhoods of Athens keep going, not compared to the size of the initial explosion, that was the big thing. It could not happen again week after week, probably. But decent events, local events with musical protests to show that we reclaim our neighborhoods from the police. That's when we started talking about moving on to a new terrain. An important sign was the ending of the Koufodinas affair. It was not the outright victory we hoped. The government didn't back down. But it was a redemptive ending that at least let us all sigh with relief. Desperate hunger strikers usually need something to hope for in order to change their mind and not sacrifice themselves. And this spring of social resistance gave Dimitris Koufodinas reasons to feel hopeful. So he decided to stop his hunger strike. And his statement was very accurate when he said that, and I quote, "What is happening out there is way more important than the issue that started. The existence of vibrant social forces that resist authoritarianism is a new hope." This new hope, he mentioned, is the big news that saved the terrain in Greece. So I'm already past time, but a couple of remarks on the protests. I'll speed it up. We are facing a government which has failed to impose its rule in a hegemonic way. Its ability to rule by consent is undermined day by day as the pandemic worsens, the crisis worsens, so on. The events of March showed that one cannot rule hidden behind police shields and buttons forever. In that sense, the right-wing government is severely weakened. But we should keep in mind that strength is not a size that can be measured in absolute terms. It's a dynamic relation between forces. And the reason Mitsotakis can still remain somehow optimistic about his protests is the condition of his political allies. The main opposition, that is Syriza in parliament, is barely an opposition. One thing is the recent past. Whenever Syriza raises some objections, the right scathingly replies, we are simply following your footsteps, so why protest? The other thing is that Syriza is transformed to a party of government, meaning a party that is trying to prove to the ruling class that it is a respectable, viable alternative, which means using the language of national unity, providing consent to crucial things like the yes vote to spend a couple of billion of dollars to buy Rafale warplanes. Syriza agreed on that. Or another example is the yes vote to the recent privatization of the southern coast of Attica. It's going to be ceded to private enterprises and transformed to a Disneyland for the rich. It was a shock for Syriza activists, those who had the illusion that past privatizations were a necessary evil because of the blackmails and so on. Right now, with the luxury to vote against it as being the opposition, Syriza chose to send a signal to the ruling class that it is a party that wishes to enable private investments so it's fit to rule again if it's needed. The Communist Party is heading into its Congress, and the main slogan of the leadership documents describe the main task as holding the party together until objective factors become more favorable someday. Now, it's true that objective factors are not easy. But this has been the party line around 20 years now for the Communist Party. It's self-limiting to a level of activity capable of reminding both workers and capitalists that it is relevant, it's a force to reckon with, but doing nothing more to change the notorious objective factors that don't allow us to do much. A crucial test is the competition with Turkey to prove one's credentials. The party has recently denounced the past strategy of revolution in stages that doomed the resistance movement in 1944, the session of Tom Bramble will be very interesting on the story of that. But while moving forward in theory, when it comes to political agitation, they will still reproduce the mainstream narrative about Turkish aggression, which is always a problem. But in the current situation, where the Greek state is firmly allied with Western imperialism and is acting provocatively, this analysis defies reality itself. The anti-capitalist left is still fragmented, confused, small, and healing its wounds from the past defeats. We face sectarianism, we face liquidationism or agnosticism. Those are problems we have to face, but some factors on the ground can help us rebuild. One is reality itself, the demand to address the needs of the semi-clandestine activity I described past autumn. The situation now is forcing us to coordinate in a serious way in order to organize resistance. I can't recall another time with so many meetings to discuss and plan strict tactics and the way forward. Second, we are reminded that a layer of politically experienced activists, the ones that were produced during past 20 years of struggle, still exist. They were scattered, they were temporarily withdrawn, but they're out there. And we saw that they are still willing to mobilize when they understand that the stakes are high. The third is the youth. Their massive presence in the recent fight back is distinct. It's generations of people that their brief lifetime consists of two major economic crises and one pandemic so far. And they're also the generations that didn't experience the defeat of 2015 as the same burden that was felt by veterans exhausted of years of fighting before that defeat. So their vibrant energy can breathe a fresh air to our organized forces, hopefully. Combining these factors will be crucial in rebuilding in the midterm, but of course ideas and politics matter. I will insist on, by using the negative examples of the reformist left in this field, internationalism, opposition to warmongering, militarism, is a crucial test in Greece right now to prove one's willingness to actually confront the ruling class and the government. This is not a given even among the far left, shaped by the Stalinist legacy in Greece. So there's a long and tough road ahead of us. For the past few years, my group has argued against extreme pessimism, emphasizing our trust on the working class to fight back and give us new opportunities. Today, we might need to be cautious against extravagant optimism and wishful thinking that we can deal with the right-wing government in a short time. But things for sure are looking way better. Sometimes reading our enemies helps understand the dynamics. In Greece, columnists of mainstream media outlets tend to mention these days the youth revolt of 2008 and the squares movement of 2011. Optimists reassure their audience that it won't happen again. Things are different now. More cautious ones warn that we must ensure that this won't happen again. Will it happen again? For now, all I can say is that it seems we are entering a new terrain with more opportunities to start reversing the defeat of 2015. It will take some serious effort, but in any case, it is telling that ghosts of struggles past are coming back to haunt our enemies. So, for the past few years, we kept our spirits high by hearing good news from France, Latin America, the second wave in the Arab world, Southeast Asia lately, Black Lives Matter past summer. Let's hope that soon enough we will have some more good news to share from Greece. Thank you.